Thank you. It's yeah, a real pleasure to be here. This is my first conference in person in a while, and it's nice to see you guys again. And a special thanks to the committee for having me here, Luis and Jim and Rosario. I really appreciate it. So, and I had a great previous talk by Stephanie. There'll be some repetition, but I was happy to see that we agree on you guys will get maybe a slightly different perspective on the same introductory material. So, we've, you know, the pioneering work by Jim and Tillman and any of you guys in the audience on these warm vapor Rydberg sensors has been great, and we're kind of following on some of that. And for those of you who may not be familiar with Army Research Labs, as many of you may not be, because we're relatively new in the quantum sciences and AMO areas, our main lab is just outside Washington, D.C. We're fairly close to the University of Maryland there in College Park and JPY, which we're happy to have a nice collaborative relationship with. Just recently, the Quantum Technology Center that has started as a joint center between ARL and the University of Maryland. And also, fairly recently, the Army has recognized the benefit of branching out geographically. And so there's a number of satellite campuses partnered with other academic institutions across the country. And one happens to be ARL South, located in Austin, Texas, University of Texas at Austin. So I'm happy to announce that I'm just starting a new lab there, GLADM Quantum Science Lab, there at the University of Texas at Austin, where we'll be starting up a new Rydberg sensor experiment. That's right. And without going any further, I want to acknowledge the wonderful team of people that I work with, responsible for all the good results that I'll be presenting today. Josh Hill and David Meyer are both in the audience here. I hope you guys get a chance to talk with them in person. They have posters outside. Kevin Cox is another original team member from the very early days of the neutral atom team. And then more recently, been a pleasure to work with Bree Anderson and Don Fahey. Don recently moved on, joined a startup company in the area. But they put in a lot of the work on the free photon Doppler-free experiment that I'll be talking to you about. So I'm going to try and cover kind of a lot of the work we've done, a brief history of our early work, and then a little bit more time on our more recent stuff. So I'll start off. I'll quickly go through, because Stephanie did a great job introducing the field, but you know, why people are interested in these warm vapor sensors. And summarize some of our early work looking at the bandwidth, again, similar to what Stephanie presented. And then go into our sensitivity calculations and comparing with some of the recent results. The bottom line is there's still room for improvement before we run up against fundamental limits in the signal to noise ratio. Then I'll highlights a work where we looked into how close can EIT spectroscopy get us to the quantum projection noise limit that we know is the fundamental limit for non-correlated, non-entangled particles. And then I'll give a little advertisement for the work by Josh Hill on the laser advances recently, where he did a very careful characterization of a VCSEL laser. This is a pretty exciting technology. This coupling laser is a bottleneck in a lot of these experiments. And then briefly characterize some of the Doppler-free spectroscopy that we've done. This is preliminary results. Our line widths are not as nice as Stephanie showed. We have a little bit different scheme, and we're not exactly motivated by turning this into a sensor immediately, I'll show you when we get there. And then finally, a direction that we're kind of excited about, which is a little bit different. Rather than coupling to a free space RF mode, if we can couple that mode into a waveguide and then have the atoms interact very strongly with the evanescent field of this waveguide, you can greatly increase the strength of that coupling and make a more sensitive sensor. This is kind of an analogous experiment to some of these nanofiber experiments. This would be the RF analogous system to that. Okay. So You kind of just saw all this, and also Seth did a nice job yesterday kind of introducing. This is, you know, artistic picture of the basic experiment. You know, the real beauty of these things is just with, it's a very simple apparatus, a glass cell of room temperature vapor. And one might argue that thanks to the advances in laser technology development, it's really made this accessible and led to the acceleration of groups around the world starting to look into this. But this very simple and elegant method of electromagnetically induced transparency, where you simultaneously and continuously excite to the Rydberg state and probe that coherent dark state, gives you this very nice narrow resonance. And then, as Seth described, that resonance is stark shifted by fields under test that you're looking at. So if we turn on the RF field, as Stephanie showed, so this is, I'm showing the resonant case where you have the AC stark shift on resonance with another nearby Rydberg transition, and you get this symmetric splitting known as Altler-Town splitting, and that can serve as a very precise calibration for the amplitude of this RF field. Okay, so like Stephanie mentioned, there's a number of unique aspects that make this sensor very different from traditional technologies, electronic-based technologies. You know, she highlighted the fact that although these Rydberg atoms, right, are enormous, gigantic floppy atoms compared to ground state atoms, they're still very small. Fun fact, so this is a tidbit that I've, this is probably familiar to the Rydberg audience, but a factoid I've given in other talks, these Rydberg atoms, say for N equals 100, is more than 10 times bigger than a coronavirus. These are enormous atoms, but still much smaller than the RF wavelengths that we're probing them with. So this leads to the ability to do sub-wavelength imaging, which some people have already realized. They are sensitive over a very wide band of frequencies, DC up to a terahertz. The fact that all these atoms are identical, of course, makes them a very nice candidate for calibration measurements. Also, we you know, have a good understanding of the fundamental noise limits, so we know how much further we can get before we start running up against these more fundamental limits, and there is still room for improvement. The fact that, again, as Stephanie mentioned, these are transparent to the RF radiation, especially as the glass cells get much, much smaller. And so that, again, leads to very high accuracy. And also large dynamic range is a feature that some applications people have brought up as being very interesting. You know, you don't have the microwave amplifiers that you can damage by sending in fields that are too strong. The atoms don't care. At worst case, you maybe ionize them for a bit, and then they re-neutralize, and you can use the sensor still. And then the fact that you have this optical readout alleviates a lot of the impedance matching issues that the you know, electronics people really struggle with when trying to make wideband receivers. Okay, so our early work on this, we started around 2016, 2017, and the first questions that we were really motivated by is trying to understand the bandwidth, and this closely related to the stuff Stephanie was talking about. And so our first foray was we demonstrated some communications. This, we happened to use a phase shift keying protocol. This is a very common protocol in electrical engineering circles. So here we happened to be encoding the information. So we were amplitude modulating the RF, and the information was encoded in the phase at which that the RF amplitude was turned on and off. And so similar to the previous talk, we, you know, park our laser on resonance, where you get the biggest difference between when the RF field is off and when it turns on. It splits down here. And so we sent, you know, some data encoded in these symbols. The black trace is what was sent, and then the red shows the output of the Rydberg sensor. And we saw that we could communicate, transmit these signals. And the critical figure of merit in these kinds of receivers is the channel capacity. This just comes from the Shannon-Hartley theorem. This kind of incorporates two important figures of merit, the instantaneous bandwidth or baseband bandwidth,
and the signal-to-noise ratio. So this is, you know, how fast can you modulate the signal and still get that information out of your sensor. And what we see is, you know, the channel capacity increases as you modulate faster and faster until you get to where your signal-to-noise ratio is one, at which point you can't get the information out anymore, and the channel capacity drops off. And this is, you know, agrees with what Stephanie was just showing you. And that corresponds to a maximum channel capacity of about 8 megabits per second. Here, this dashed line is kind of the raw data, and the dot, this is corrected if you subtract off some of the technical noise and assume photon shot noise limited. This corresponds to the channel capacity that we measured. And so, you know, the limiting factor in this system, it comes from this EIT spectroscopy. And in addition to this intermediate state lifetime, as Stephanie mentioned, the 50 nanoseconds kind of is the fastest you can read out, and that corresponds to twice the natural line width. So the natural lifetime in rubidium case is about 24 nanoseconds, kind of the fastest that this transition can scatter photons, and that's where this 50 nanosecond speed limit comes from. Now, this is not an absolute limit or a fundamental limit. Of course, there's other ways you could imagine trying to extract the information, but for this nice, simple, elegant EIT scheme, that's kind of the limit that you're up against. So one interesting aspect of this that is quite distinct, again, from the traditional electronic technologies, is that this bandwidth is independent of the size. And so if you talk to electronics engineers who are antenna engineers, you know, that are trying to design smaller antennas, you know, for our cell phones and still have them operate at higher and higher bandwidths, they run up against this fundamental limit that comes from Maxwell's equations. This is known as the Chu limit. This is not the AMO Stephen Chu. This is a different Chu. But what they find is that as the size of the antenna, characterized here by A, becomes smaller than the wavelength of the radiation, the Q goes up dramatically. It goes up as the third power of the ratio of those sizes. And so with the atoms, they're not beholden to this limit. They're not antennas. So there's some assumptions. You know, what is an antenna? Here, the assumption is it's conductive, it's passive. And they're assuming lossless. So of course you can sacrifice some sensitivity by adding a resistor, some damping, and you can broaden that bandwidth by reducing the Q that way. So, but the atoms have, you know, especially in this very low wavelength, long wavelength, low frequency regime, are not beholden to this Chu limit, and so they have this kind of consistent 10 megahertz, 5 to 10 megahertz bandwidth, which is nice. Okay, so taking advantage of this, you know, decent 10 megahertz is a decent bandwidth. It's enough to transmit a video, which is what we're showing here. So this is kind of a fun lab demo that people get a kick out of when they come visit the lab. So I'll play it again, but basically what you're looking at is there's a camera here. This is kind of a very meta demo. So a camera here is taking an image of the experiment. That data is being encoded on a carrier RF wave being broadcast by this horn here. It impinges upon the atoms, and the atoms transduce that information onto the optical laser beams that we detect with a photodetector, demodulate that information, and transmit it over to the computer screen here. So I'll play this one more time in case you didn't see it. Is this going to work? All right, let me try one more time. Uh-oh, is it frozen now? Oh, there it goes. Okay. So, right, so the camera, so you're seeing the image broadcast here. I come in and I'll pick up the atoms, and of course the transduction can't happen anymore. The atoms aren't there to encode the information on the laser beams. The signal goes away. I drop the vapor cell back into its holder, give some time for the lasers to relock, and then the signal comes back. So kind of a fun little demo. People get a kick out of that. And there's other groups. The NIST group has had a lot of fun with this, the recording songs and playing guitars, all kinds of silly things. Okay, so that's kind of as our first foray into Rydberg sensing. We learned a little bit about the bandwidth. Then we wanted to understand the sensitivity limits. And so we started off by applying our favorite canonical two-level model, quantum sensor model, where you know, we understand the limits quite well. And so, you know, the signal to noise. So we define the sensitivity here as the minimum detectable field when the signal to noise ratio equals one in a 1 second measurement bandwidth. Okay, so the signal in this case is the phase evolution from this Stark shift times the interaction time tau. And we know that the noise limit, the best resolution you can achieve reading out the phase of a quantum system like this, is 1 over the square root of the number of atoms. And then, of course, if there's some decoherence in the system, you have to account for that. You don't get the full interaction time, so you have to scale by the square root of the ratio of that decoherence time to your measurement time. And we're left with this familiar equation where the signal-to-noise ratio scales with the square root of the atoms and the interaction time. Okay, so that nice, simple model. Of course, there's some complicating factors that we have to take into account. As Seth mentioned, there's almost an infinity of states for these Rydberg systems. So that complicates things. And then, of course, the Stark shift does not scale uniformly. If you're near resonance, you get this Otler-Town splitting where the Stark shift scales linearly with the electric field, and the proportionality factor is the dipole moment, as we learned. Whereas if you're off resonance, if you're far away from a resonance, then it becomes a square law detector. It scales quadratically with the electric field. And then there's a prefactor here, which would be the polarizability of the atom. And this is what Seth was telling us about yesterday. So taking all those complications into account, we can model the system here. So take, for example, one target state. So we tune our lasers to, say, the 50 D5 half state. And then we look at the response, the Stark shift of that state, as we scan the RF frequencies from 10 megahertz up to terahertz. And you see that down here you have the DC Stark shift. And then as you get to these resonant enhancements, you see all the Rydberg resonances as you scan those frequencies. And this happens to be for a fairly strong field, 100 millivolts per meter. The question we really want to ask is, okay, for some arbitrary RF field, where do we want to park our laser? Which Rydberg target state do we want to address to optimize the sensitivity to that RF field? And so David Meyer in the audience created this beautiful plot, did that big numerical calculation. And so here we limited ourselves to n equals 100, which is somewhat arbitrary, but kind of a reasonable state to still get good signal to noise given the laser powers that we have readily in the lab. This also happens to assume rubidium, which is the species that we use. So in this plot, sensitivity here on the y-axis improves as you go down, so smaller minimum detectable field in 1 second. And then this model also assumes 1,000 atoms, which is maybe somewhat conservative, but reasonable, and then a T2 time of 3 megahertz. And so we see some features here. Each of these points are down here are the resonant delta n equals 1. So when you have a resonance between the next nearest Rydberg state, here's a delta n equals 2, 3, 4, so on. And then we see the, you know, three orders of magnitude difference between the resonant enhancement versus being off resonant. And so naturally one would want to ask, okay, how does this compare to, you know, an electronic receiver, say a dipole antenna coupled to a readout resistor or a diode? So here we plotted this line. this would be, you know, and oh, and another thing to try and keep it apples to apples, we've assumed a 1 centimeter system size. So a 1 centimeter vapor cell and 1 centimeter dipole, center-fed dipole antenna. So if you couple that 1 centimeter dipole antenna to a 50 ohm load, you see the resonance, the first half wavelength resonance there, just above 10 gigahertz. And then you see the nodes when the wavelength is, you get zero field on the center of the antenna. But you see that, and here for this electronic system, we're assuming Johnson noise limited of the 50 ohms. And so we see that the Rydberg atoms are, you know, near, but still not beating just a simple dipole antenna and a 50 ohm resistor. And so it's kind of stiff competition. You can buy a paperclip and a resistor and for pretty cheap. And so just going head to head on that one figure of merit is maybe a hard sell. So you have to think about those other features that we mentioned in the beginning that make this attractive. And so what's the current state of the art of experimental results? Here's some exemplar points. This one here is Jim Schaefer's group, where they first demonstrated some nice heterodyne, homodyne readout schemes. This is a group out of China that kind of did, you know, really polished it up, did as best they could do. This corresponds to, I think, about five microvolts per meter sensitivity per root hertz. The interesting point down here, so this very low field measurement, you notice this is better than what we predict, and that's thanks to this quadratic square law sensor regime where they were operating far off resonance, and you can use a second local oscillator field to get some effective gain, basically heterodyning with the atoms. And that we did not take that into account in this model, so there's clearly some other tricks that you can play to, you know, reach this. But this is assuming perfect, quantum limited readout, so achieving the signal to noise at the quantum projection limit. Maybe just one more point of context. The limits here, so this is you know, a couple microvolts per meter per root hertz. The FM radio in your car, that corresponds to about a half a millivolt per meter field and a 400 kilohertz bandwidth. So in 1 hertz, that corresponds to less than a microvolt per meter. Or for, you know, centimeter scale, that's, you know, single digit nanovolts per meter. So we still have a ways to go if, you know, again, just trying to compete head to head on sensitivity is tough. Okay, so then the next question, again, that model assumed, you know, ideal quantum limited readout. But can this EIT method actually achieve standard quantum limited readout? And so that's what was addressed in this paper. David, first author, great job on this. And so another way to frame this question is how accurately does the two-level block sphere model agree with what's actually going on this three-level readout scheme? And the bottom line is, so this is kind of the simplest scheme. This is ignoring Doppler broadening, so a cold atom sample and negligible dephasing of the end states. This is kind of the best you can do. And the analytic model, so here's scaling with optical depth, your question from the last talk, we see that the standard quantum limit, so this is kind of the scaling with the square root of the atom number, and we see that as you increase the optical depth, the EIT readout approaches the standard quantum limit, but it never quite reaches it. And you can derive an analytic model that works for low optical depths. Once you get above one, it gets less accurate, so you have to start resorting to a numeric model. But nevertheless, EIT can never actually achieve the standard quantum limit. And so down this bottom plot here is the ratio between the two. So how close can it get? It gets to 3.5 dB away. So you know, 1.5 times away from the standard quantum limit. So this is motivation to start considering alternate ways for probing these systems. And you know, unfortunately, the story gets worse as you start incorporating these other decoherence and broadening mechanisms, especially Doppler broadening, which Stephanie was telling us about. So now, considering, so again, this is a pretty hefty numerical model that David did a great job on. You take a slice that's optically thin, you integrate over all the Doppler velocities, you feed the output of that slice into the next slice. So there's a lot of numerical integration here. But the takeaway is that you know, in a Doppler broadened sample, the story just gets worse. And so these orange, green, and red dashed lines are still for very cold, very small Doppler broadening. This is the D2 Doppler width for kind of room temperature Doppler broadening, 520 megahertz for rubidium. You see that it's dramatically worse. And this is, you know, these lines here are kind of assuming infinite laser power. And as you get to, you know, more and more atoms, more thicker optical depths, it really demands unrealistic laser powers. So here's kind of some exemplar lines for maybe achievable laser powers and room temperature atoms, and you see that it's you know, orders of magnitude away from the quantum limit using this EIT spectroscopy. So motivation to start looking for alternate schemes. So there's room for improvement there. Now, as I mentioned, you know, lasers, there's a lot of components, even though this is a relatively simple experimental apparatus, especially compared to the tweezer arrays that we heard about this morning, there still are some, you know, a lot of technology component development that would be needed to get these things out into the real world. One of the most expensive ones are the lasers. And so we've, you know, looked at some new laser technology. This is a VCSEL. So, you know, close cousin to the VCSEL. So these are, rather than the gain medium being in a layer, this is fabricated layer by layer, and the fabrication process is much cheaper than you get for these Fabry-Perot semiconductor laser diodes. And the VCSEL means the external cavity, so vertical external cavity semiconductor laser. And so, these you can get very high powers, and as Josh measured, also very nice narrow line widths thanks to this external cavity. So here's kind of the Lorentzian line width. There was some, you know, residual environmental noise. So if you integrate over longer times, the Gaussian width gets a little bit broader, but still quite respectable. And so using this laser with all its power, we were able to measure a 3.5 megahertz EIT line width. And this is in the standard 2-photon counterpropagating. So this is basically getting up against the residual Doppler broadening that Stephanie mentioned. And so, and this was just in a single sweep. So very nice signal and noise. Thanks to the large power, we can make the beams big, talk to a lot of atoms, and in a single 3-millisecond sweep across the resonance, we get nice signal noise and narrow EIT line width. So just kind of summarizing, right, the nice points about this laser is it's high power, low noise. It can be widely tunable, 10 nanometers tunability, and it can be simple and meaning lower cost than these doubled lasers that you buy from Topica, for example. There are still some engineering challenges. This was kind of the first prototype, and there's room for improvement here. One of the biggest annoyances that Josh ran across is as you try and tune this laser over its wide range, you get very dramatic drops, fluctuations in the power, like factors of 2 or 10. And there are some ideas about what's behind that, and so I think that can be addressed. Also, this kind of relates to the external cavity design, of course, with the larger cavity. it's more susceptible to acoustic noise, and that was also apparent because it has to be water chilled, and so there were some challenges there in the lab for reducing that. Okay, how am I doing on time? Good. Okay. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about the Doppler-free experiments that we've started. And again, this is kind of preliminary data. And Stephanie kind of already explained the idea here, that the idea is just to cancel out the momentum kick that the atoms would feel. And Schaefer's group has found this nice coincidence for cesium. There happens to be this combination of laser wavelengths that you can make collinear and get almost completely Doppler-free, zero residual K vector. For our case, we had some of these lasers on hand, and so in order to cancel out the momentum kick from these wavelengths, we have to go to these specific angles. So it's harder to align, and this is obvious. There's a drawback if you want to use this as a sensor, because now your interaction volume, your overlap volume, is much smaller compared to this collinear regime. But nevertheless, this is interesting for other reasons. So the first appealing aspect is that you're talking to all the velocity classes, and so your signal can go up because you're talking to many more atoms for a given volume. And so we confirmed that. Here's the experimental points as we tune these laser beams. The black stars here are for the wavelengths in a collinear regime where there's still some residual Doppler broadening. So we're only talking to a subset of the velocity classes, whereas if we change the angles to this Doppler-free configuration, we get more and more atoms, and this basically agrees with what we expect. Oh, 2 minutes. Okay, I better speed up. So we did some large contour plots, and again, get nice qualitative agreement from our simulations and our experiment. Here's, in the collinear, and then as you go to this Doppler-free, you get a single nice peak, and here's, just example slices taken out here. And we see the agreement is decent, although not quite perfect. And here's maybe highlighting some of the disagreements a little bit more. So the line width is amazingly robust for this Doppler-free configuration. It's consistently about 10 megahertz. Maybe goes from 7 megahertz to 12 megahertz as we vary the probe Rabi frequency by a factor of 10 almost, whereas the simulation, expects that you'd get basically linear power broadening as you turn up that probe Rabi frequency. And so this indicates that there's some residual broadening that our simulation has not taken into account, and we're looking into that. Here again, this kind of tells the same story as we simulate what the line width should be as we change one of the beam's angles relative to the other. You get these different slopes with the minimum when you're exactly canceling the Doppler. Our experimental points have quite different slopes. I'll maybe move on to this last few things I want to cover. So this is this waveguide experiment that we're excited about. And this, give credit to Kevin Cox for spearheading this. So the idea here, as I mentioned in the introduction, is to couple the RF field into this waveguide, and then the evanescent field very near to the surface is, of course, very concentrated, and so you can get couplings between this field and the atoms that are much increased. And so we engineer this waveguide such that the evanescent mode size roughly matches our laser beam size, where our atom interaction area is. And so here's a picture of what it looks like in real life. So we just bolted this waveguide into a stainless steel chamber. You can play all the normal tricks, on the front end, and the atoms are now just serving as kind of the back end readout, so you can put on whatever antenna you want and some amplification. And bottom line is you, of course, get a much better sensitivity. The purple is kind of a COMSOL prediction of this particular waveguide that was designed. And then the raw data points shown in blue. If we subtract off some of the technical noise, you get the points in green. If you allow yourself to put an amplifier on the front end, you can get the gain you'd expect. But anyways, we get a nice increase in sensitivity down to minus 40 dBm per hertz. And a dream might be to get to sub-thermal noise temperatures, which would mean we still have about another 25, 30 dB to go. And you may worry about surface interactions, but that would be the dream there. And as I mentioned, the dynamic range is another appealing aspect. So this shows that with this system, we have over 80 dB of linear dynamic range. Another fun demo, just by putting up rabbit ears next to the window of our lab, we were able to pick up AM radio stations, FM radio stations, and all the Bluetooth and Wi-Fi bouncing around the lab. So this is, really think of this analogously to a spectrum analyzer. So this is, operating over 0 to 20 gigahertz. And then one last advertisement, hot off the press. One cool thing that you can do with Rydberg atoms that you cannot do with electronic technology is sense simultaneously with a single sensor head frequencies that go from 2 gigahertz to 120 gigahertz, so over 100 gigahertz range. And you can measure both the amplitude and the phase quadrature of these signals. This is five signals spanning over 115 gigahertz, all measured simultaneously. So this is kind of an exciting thing that Rydberg atoms can do that would be really hard with traditional technology. I'll just summary, I'm kind of out of time. Thank you for your attention.
We have time for a few questions.
So just in this last part with the waveguide, so you showed something where there was frequency up to 20 gigahertz and sensitivity or something, but how do you measure this? Are you looking at lots of different Rydberg transitions or?
No, we are tuning the local oscillator. That's how we're scanning the 0 to 20 gigahertz. But the Rydberg state is staying consistent over that span.
Ah, I see. So this is beating the local oscillator. You're beating the measured signal you want to measure against this local oscillator.
Exactly. And local oscillator is also being fed into the waveguide.
I see. Okay. And then you mentioned about surface interactions or stray fields. Do you know how much they impact your measurement or how much do you worry about them?
Well, so there's also electrodes, DC electrodes on there that we use to cancel background fields. And we have not explicitly seen noise that we can attribute to the surface yet. This was still, a couple millimeters away from the surface, and that hasn't been the limitation yet. There were other limitations in that experiment, namely the fact that the waveguide only covered a portion of the path that the beams traversed, so there was a lot of atoms that weren't interacting with the field. There was gradients, as you encounter the waveguide and then go off the waveguide. So we have next generation experiments of these on the way.
Yeah, thanks.
One more question.
You mentioned in the end multiple frequency detection simultaneously. So I guess that it means you have linear response of the system when all these different frequencies arrive. But how do you extract data from each separate frequencies? Are they modulated at different frequencies and then you extract or?
So there's actually, at each kind of tone, there's a local oscillator as well. So there's two, and you have to be a little bit careful. You can't have it be exactly on resonance or You don't get. You need to be in this DC Stark shift regime, quadratic regime, so that you can extract the information. But yes, the data I was showing was there was modulations, phase modulations on the signal beam, but each one had an RF local oscillator, and all of the information gets put into the baseband bandwidth. So you're kind of limited to this 10 megahertz baseband bandwidth. And that's maybe one of the limitations, but yes, all of the signals you can measure both in amplitude and phase quadrature.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, let's move on. Let's thank the speaker again.